when the tape ended, we were talking about Saul Alinsky and his arrival on campus.
Right. So this is in the evening, probably 8 o'clock at night. And here's Alinsky coming in. He's expected to have a nice, quiet evening in a motel. And here he is with a bunch of meeting a bunch of students. And I'm standing there with this itinerary in my hand. And I introduced myself and shook his hand. And he says, "What's that?" And I said, "Well, that's your itinerary." And he looks at it. He says, "Jesus, when am I going to have time to take a piss?" So I figured there was trouble in River City. And did my best, you know, to smooth it over and discovered what had happened and, you know, apologize for not getting the communication right. And he turned out to be just a terrific person. I was at several gatherings with him, and of course I was most interested in hearing him, but it was a very successful symposium. Hannah was at one of the lunches we had, which just tickled Ed Carlin, you know, beyond belief. Alinsky and Hannah had served on the I think it was the Civil Rights Commission.
Okay.
Right? And so, you know, so that was a wonderful thing. So I felt, you know, engaged right away, not only in the classroom with some help and terror, but engaged in what was going on in the university, and certainly in the college and in the university. And then I was elected right away to the Department Advisory Council. And I still don't know why, but, you know, I mean, I was brand new there. And this, as I recall, this was a general election. You know, this was, I don't know if they had by ranks or not, but at any rate. So then I became more engaged in the department, you know, the activities of the department and the management of the department. So the first year was a really kind of a active year, and in the spring of '68, again there were some meetings about unions for faculty. I recall one, a university college group, and Keith Grody was, at that time, an assistant professor over in labor and industrial relations. And he was there as kind of an expert. And I, after discussions, I made the comment that I didn't see that there was anything to lose in trying to organize. And his comment was, "Well, that was the way he looked at it too." Well, what's interesting about that is that Keith Grody was then hired by the university to defeat the organizing campaigns. The first attempt, I think, do you want me to go through kind of the organizing stuff?
Mm-hmm.
First attempt really started, I think, in 69, or must have been 69. And they attempted first to identify the university college as a bargaining unit, distinct from the rest of the university. And that didn't go anywhere. I think Mary Tompkins and Gladys Beckwith were the major forces in that. I didn't have much to do with that. But then through 69, there were meetings. It got, one of the moving colleges was the College of Education, in that particular movement. I remember John Sear was president. And I would go to the meetings, but I really wasn't in a position I didn't think to take a very active role. And then in 1970, while they're trying to collect cards and all, I went over to James Madison College. At that time, the writing program at James Madison was staffed by ATL. And we had, I think, three people over there teaching a special social science-oriented curriculum. That was let me back up a little bit, because the other thing that was happening in 1969 was a great deal of resistance to the common syllabus. Okay? They were hiring in a bunch of young, hotshot PhDs from all over. I mean, we were hiring 8 to 10 people a year, and some of the people that came in, that K. Rout, Mesa Lazelle, I mean, who are still here now, came in that year. About a year later, Dick Thomas came in, and several more who finally left ATL, who really wanted, I think, to get into graduate teaching and went on to Carbondale and out to Evergreen College and Washington, D.C. College. So there was a lot of discussion about the curriculum at that time. And the first part of that movement was to, if not eliminate the common final examination, at least to add some writing to it, where the students would have to actually go in and write an essay.
It was a multiple choice prior to that? Or?
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It was almost entirely a subject matter. Common final examination in the auditorium. Part of your job was to monitor that, Well, hell, you didn't know who these, it was very difficult to monitor. Mm-hmm. Somebody could come in and take the test for somebody else. Although there were attempts to monitor. It wasn't just to open, But at any rate, that was, people were taking the writing more seriously, I think. And that was a growing movement in the department, a growing concern in the department. Then, of course, when the with that growing emphasis or interest in evaluating writing at the end of the course, there was also more interest in what was going on in terms of writing in the course. So there are a lot of discussions about that. Then, of course, they've a lot of people who had a divergence of interests in terms of the subject matter, and so there was a movement to develop the track system with different subject matter focuses. All of this is kind of the turmoil, of 1960, late 68, 69, 69 to 70. And, of course, there were dire predictions that the college would be eliminated, that all coherence would break down. And these, of course, these predictions were coming largely from the older faculty. Change is often uncomfortable, but interestingly, the movement for this change prevailed. I remember Milt Powell being very important in that. Uh, I guess the motto was to offer choices to the students instead of having a lockstep curriculum that everybody had to take. Offer the students some choice in subject matter. Well, one of the first ones was the American Radical Thought, which I taught in the spring of 1970. Took that length of time to get the curricular change through that way. And I don't remember what the other ones were. I was just interested in that one. And, of course, there's the turmoil, you know, out in the streets and out in the country during this time. So about the, it must have been maybe a month into the course, May of 1970, I'm teaching American Radical Thought. And I'm in the classroom, and the fire alarm goes off. And we go out, and the streets are filled. And this was the shooting at Kent State. And the students were protesting, and a lot of faculty, I went out and joined it. We marched, you know, down Farm Lane and around Shaw Lane. And there was just all sorts of just turmoil. And I, in a sense, turned the course into a practicum at that point. And met with the students, and we decided how we were going about handling this. And I thought this would be pretty good subject matter. You know, here was a kind of incipient revolution in process, and they were supposed to report and write about what was going on, why it was going on, and who was doing what, and all that. Which actually I thought was a pretty creative, I didn't just cancel class, as several faculty did. And there were faculty meetings, good Lord, all over. Norm Pollock was surfaced. I, of course, had known him, known his name. I had not met him. I had known his name because he had written about the populists. And he was among the group, Bill Derman, there were others who were quite active in trying to draft a statement about the war in Vietnam and the responsibility of citizens and the role of faculty and students and all of that, you know. So that was the student strike during the spring of 1970. I think Walter Adams was president at that point. And there were... I just remember that. I'm not quite certain. I think he was. It may have been. No, didn't he follow? I think he followed.
He was in interim, and then followed by Horton.
Yeah, he was interim between why am I not remembering his name? Hannah and Wharton.
And Wharton,
right. Yeah. So he must have been. He must have been president at that point, and handled it actually fairly well. Then that fall, I went over to James Madison College, fall 1970. So that's as part of the sort of track movement. Then the reason I backed up was that to explain that Madison had its own social science focus for the writing program there. That had been accepted, you know, because of what was happening in ATL generally. So 1970, I'll try not to go hour by hour here, Jeff.
No, that's fine. Glad you remember it in detail.
but 1970, you know, then of course we had, I had my hair down over my shoulders, Grew a beard, and since I'd come clean shaven and in a crew cut, that was quite a change. And James Madison was a very lively place, very young faculty, quite supportive, a little elitist, I thought. But it was a good place to teach, and the students, of course, were terrific. Anytime you have students making choices of a program like that, I think you start with engagement, and so they were very nice to work with. Did the work, capable. Some of them were, picked up on the radical side. I think of John Royal, who was SDS, very active in SDS. And he was ultimately, arrested and charged for obstructing ROTC. I maybe come back to that because I got involved in that. And Meg Beagle was active in SDS. She was one of the students I hired for the Autolite research. There were several very good, and one of them who was one of the students I had a lot of contact with because he was quite torn by what was going on in Vietnam and what his responsibilities were, and whether he should go to Canada or whether he should just resist, or I became kind of informal counselor for some of the students that way. And he surfaced about 3 or 4 years ago, and staff of the National Security Advisory Council in D.C. And the reason when I say surfaced is because he was interviewed for the Alumni Magazine, and he remembered me, and I certainly remembered him. But that was I would held office hours at night. Mm-hmm. We'd have students over to the house. It was a very nice teaching situation. And in the midst of this, near the end of it, then the collective bargaining election, the first collective bargaining election was held. Well, I was out of the department, yet in the department. It was a very strange situation because I stayed on the advisory council, was elected to the advisory council while I was teaching over in James Madison College. Hmm. But I was very, I was very engaged in the teaching and everything over there. So I really didn't play much of a role in that first election in 1972. And that seemed to me to have a very heavy NEA presence. Maybe take a brief break here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're talking about the first unionization effort in 1972.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't have many distinct memories of it because I was not very actively involved. I was so busy in Madison that, well, I was supportive, and signed the cards. I didn't play really much of a leadership role.
Who was in leadership in that first moment?
Well, I think that's when John Steer, I know Gladys and Mary Tompkins were quite active then. I think John Ferris was active out of our department. Who the university-wide figures were at that time, I don't really remember.
Mm-hmm.
But the election occurred, and it ran against organizing. I don't remember the vote, but the probably 600 or 700 votes for collective bargaining, all total.
Mm-hmm.
And then that just kind of went on a back burner. I mean, it was there was still some interest. The faculty associates, which was affiliated with the Michigan Education Association, continued to exist. The AAUP, of course, had been around on campus for a long time. They were quite cool to collective bargaining. And I was a member of AAUP and a member of faculty associates at the same time. And the dues for faculty associates were very low. The AAUP was really quite centrist about everything, you know, on campus. The free speech issues, you know, the Garskoff case, you know, I thought they might have handled a little better. He was the fellow in psychology who gave blanket A's. And it was that kind of a time, though, where people did strange things, mm-hmm. you know. And with the war in the background, the so-called liberation, you know, sexual liberation, and all this, it was a time of some turmoil. But with the faculty who were interested in collective bargaining, interesting to me, were quite focused on the campus and on the way decisions were made on campus. Now, there was a faculty governance. Now, I always thought it was very interesting that words are often interesting, and governance is one of those interesting words. It's clearly short of government. What it means is not altogether clear. That is, if you think in terms of power, that is, power who has the power to make a decision, the power to act, the power to determine the way things will go, it was clear to me that that the governance system did not have any of those powers. It was advisory in many ways. In most ways, it had the power, perhaps, to embarrass the administration. You know, I was never really interested in running for university-wide offices, partly because it just didn't seem to be a very effective use of time. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. And there were, you know, to give AAUP credit, there were several members of the AAUP who were also concerned about the weakness in governance. You know, this had to come out of the John Hanna period, and John was a very strong president. You know. And, you know, the governance might be something like his kitchen cabinet, I would imagine. You know, but he certainly felt free to accept or reject any advice that came his way. Well, there were some movements, though, in governance at that time to try and strengthen the hand of governance. And part of that movement, of course, was in response to the threat of collective bargaining. And so they tried to identify things that were absolutely the prerogative of the faculty, and that the administration would have a great deal of difficulty overturning faculty action, you know, and it wasn't impossible, but it was difficult. So there were some revisions made in the tenure system, I think, first, you know, and that was strengthened. There were some hearing panels set up, etc. The other area of faculty determination was curriculum. Right. So those two, I think the power of faculty in those two areas were strengthened during this period. And I'd say partly as a response to collective bargaining. Collective bargaining wasn't such a way out idea on campus, and certainly not in Michigan with its long union tradition, but Central Michigan had also, Central Michigan had organized by that time. I mean, they were organized before the campaign at MSU. I'd say they must have organized 67 or 68.
Mm-hmm. I was there then.
Yeah.
As a student.
Yeah. So there's a union in place there. It was working. And there was a movement nationally at that time. And there weren't many major institutions that had chosen collective bargaining. Right? But there were elections around. You know, the California system and Rutgers, and I don't remember all of them at the time. So it was, of course, on campus it was viewed as a pretty damn radical idea.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean this. I don't remember exactly when, but year or two after the election, so it must have been maybe 74 or something like that. Maybe 75, because personally, let's see, yes, it must have been 75 that I was approached. See, I was doing fairly well then. I'd received a grant from Rockefeller for the summer of 73 and the summer of 74 to do research on, first on the Autolite strike in Toledo, second on the Minneapolis Teamsters strike. These were oral history-based projects. And I had hired two students from James Madison, Claude Kostansky and Meg Beagle, to go down to Autolite. We rented a place there and really got into the community and did several really good interviews with very important people. And that resulted in a manuscript and then a book. And then the summer of 74, I went to Minneapolis and hired, these are two more James Madison students, Phil Fishman, whose father was the political head of the UAW in the state. Oh, that didn't determine why I chose him. He was just very good. And Janet Topolsky was another student. And we went to Minneapolis and rented a place there and conducted interviews in Minneapolis. And I was publishing some things, and, you know, so I guess my level of confidence was high enough that and by then I guess I had decided that maybe the academic life was a good life after all. Which in a way makes me curious why I would begin to risk it, but I did. Mary Tompkins and Gladys Beckwith approached me and said, you know, to recruit me to be the president of the Faculty Associates. Which, you know, I thought over and then I agreed to do, with in mind bringing about another and hopefully a more successful election. So, and I must have been about 75 or 76, because shortly after, we began circulating cards again for another election. And that time, you know, as president of the Faculty Associates, I was, of course, there on the cusp. And I would write my Tom Paine letters, you know, the points of view, and try to recruit people to work out in the faculty community to see if we couldn't get enough support to bring about an election and hopefully then to win the election. And it was an interesting process, partly because of the way the campus divided on this issue. I think except for James Madison College, which was quite small, if you kind of drew a line south of the Red Cedar and north of the Red Cedar. That would kind of divide, the support and the hostility. Not just opposition, but hostility to collective bargaining. It is the sciences, the ag school, all of those groups were really quite hostile to collective bargaining. And I, at this point, I have to include the College of Education as well, although there were still strong supporters there. Things had changed in sort of the demographics of teaching in the state. And this was when they were beginning to talk about the plethora of education students and no jobs, and the MEA had gotten into a kind of quota discussion, and MSU was, of course, Central Michigan, which produced teachers, was an affiliate of the MEA. So there was charges that they were receiving favored treatment. But enrollment was dropping off in the College of Education. And, of course, that meant jobs, and et cetera. So they were, there was a lot of anxiety and a lot of hostility to MEA. Even those who might support collective bargaining were hostile to MEA because they felt, I suppose, betrayed by MEA. And I remember...